Ascent Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents Demise of the Dollar, From the Bailouts to the Pandemic and Beyond, 3rd edition, by Addison Wiggin. Foreword by James Rickards. Narrated by Garrett Michael Brown. Limit of Liability, Disclaimer of Warranty. While the publisher and author have used their best efforts in preparing this book, they make no representations or warranties with respect to the accuracy or completeness of the contents of this book, and specifically disclaim any implied warranties of merchantability or fitness for a particular purpose. No warranty may be created or extended by sales representatives or written sales materials. The advice and strategies contained herein may not be suitable for your situation. You should consult with a professional where appropriate. Further, readers should be aware that websites listed in this work may have changed or disappeared between when this work was written and when it is read. Neither the publisher nor authors shall be liable for any loss of profit or any other commercial damages, including but not limited to special, incidental, consequential, or other damages. The empire will end. All empires do. And since it was financed by debt rather than by tribute, it will end in a financial disaster. The cost, I mean the money lost on the imperial adventure, will have to be reckoned with, and the only way to do that is by incinerating it in inflation. Bill Bonner. Foreword. James Rickards. Making monetary economics complex and inaccessible to all but experts is easy. All you have to do is follow the crowd of mainstream PhD economists, use lots of jargon, like non-accelerating inflation rate of unemployment, NARU, and downward nominal wage rigidity, DNWR. Adopt some handy models, such as the Phillips curve, and you're all set. No one will understand what you're saying, but you'll win applause from pundits and Wall Street cheerleaders who will welcome you to the club of incomprehensible insiders. Making monetary economics straightforward and accessible to everyday Americans is hard. First, you have to understand the technical concepts yourself, including their many flaws. Then you have to translate the jargon into plain English. Finally, you have to write in a clear style with a strong dose of history for context and a pinch of humor. The irony is that the accessible version is closer to the truth of how money works than the complex version. There are two reasons for this. The first is that the jargon is just jargon. I've done economic analysis at the highest levels of difficulty for more than 40 years, and I've yet to encounter a concept that could not be clearly stated in plain English. For example, downward nominal wage rigidity just means that people don't like pay cuts. Non-accelerating inflation rate of employment means that if labor is scarce, wages and inflation go up as a result. Is it really so difficult to write plainly? The answer, it's not difficult at all if you're willing to shed the suit of armor jargon most economists wear to bed. The second reason is that most of the models used by economists and the jargon used to describe them are simply wrong. I once examined the list of all winners of the Nobel Prize in Economics and discovered that about one-third of the prizes were given for contributions that are completely false. Ben Bernanke won the prize in 2022 for research on banks and financial crises, yet his leadership at the Federal Reserve caused the worst financial crisis since the Great Depression and led to the failures of Bear Stearns, Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac, and Lehman Brothers. Eugene Fama won in 2013 for his theory of efficient markets. But markets are not efficient at all. They're wild and unpredictable, and subject to crashes and bubbles. To be clear, there are some notable winners who made solid contributions to economics, but many of the prizes were given for junk science. The biggest joke of all is that the Nobel Prize in Economics is not even a real Nobel Prize. The original Nobel Prizes were awarded for physics, chemistry, medicine, literature, and peace, beginning in 1901. In 1969, the Swedish Central Bank created the Sveriges Riksbank Prize in Economic Sciences in memory of Alfred Nobel, funded by the Central Bank. The original Nobel Prizes were funded by the estate of Alfred Nobel. You can think of the Nobel Prize in Economics as a wannabe prize, frequently awarded for ideas that don't hold water. Another example of junk science in economics is the Phillips curve. This is not just some arcane theory. It's at the center of Federal Reserve interest rate policy today. The theory is that low unemployment causes higher inflation, and high unemployment reduces inflation. The relationship between unemployment and inflation can be represented on a graph as a downward sloping curve. The only problem with the theory is that it's not true. The period in the late 1960s did see low unemployment and rising inflation, yet the late 1970s saw high unemployment and high inflation, so-called stagflation. The period from 2013 to 2019 saw low unemployment and low inflation. Inflation didn't really take off until 2021. So, where's the correlation? There isn't any. It's a fake theory with no empirical support. Still, the Fed swears by it. Is it any surprise that current monetary policy is driving the U.S. economy over a cliff? What do solid economic analysis and clear writing actually look like? They look like this book by Addison Wiggin. The demise of the dollar is a sterling example in the use of models that hold up in the real world and jargon-free exposition. This book is not only up to date and clear, it's an invaluable guide to navigating the uncharted economic waters that surround us. To explain inflation, Addison does not need the Phillips curve. He simply compares prices of everyday goods like eggs, milk, and gas at the pump to what they cost a year or 2 years ago. That's the thing about inflation. You can't spin it. The price of food and fuel is in your face every day. You don't need a flawed model. You just have to watch your credit card balance go up and your savings account balance go down, and you'll know more about inflation than those trapped in an ivory tower at Harvard or in the West Wing. Another great strength of his book is that Addison includes a heavy dose of history. Listeners generally enjoy historical context for current events. History is like the spoonful of sugar that helps the economic medicine go down. Yet, it's more than that. Inflation does not just drop out of the sky. It builds slowly through a succession of monetary policy blunders by the Federal Reserve and fiscal policy negligence by the Congress and White House. Addison takes us through the long litany of such blunders that has accrued over decades. Addison looks at the creation of the Federal Reserve, 1913, Bretton Woods, 1944, the Marshall Plan, 1948 through 1954, and Nixon's suspension of the convertibility of dollars for gold, 1971, among other notable economic milestones. He explains why the United States and the world achieved strong growth and low inflation, 1944 to 1971, followed by weak growth and high inflation, 1971 through 1982, and then the age of King Dollar, 1983 through 2008. When the world learned to live without a gold standard, but was utterly dependent on the petrodollar standard. Since 2008, we've encountered one crisis after another, including financial panic, pandemic panic, supply chain breakdown, and now a full-scale shooting war in Europe with a financial war side by side. We abandoned solid economic policy in 1971. And are now reaping the bitter fruit of flawed policies ever since. Best of all, Addison is not a doom and gloomer. He's forthright in his analysis and criticism, but also positive in his recommendations. We are not victims. There are many ways to preserve wealth and even prosper in the most difficult economic times, and Addison lays these out clearly with specific recommendations for portfolio allocations and strategies. I'm confident you will enjoy listening to this book as much as I did, and I'm equally confident that you will come away from it with greater confidence in the future and a reliable playbook on how to survive. Introduction. Fistful of Dollars. December 15th, 2022. Dear listener, we are living through a great inflation. It's why we feel pain at the pump, and why we grimace at the appalling price of a carton of eggs. It is also why the Fed is raising interest rates more aggressively than they have in half a century. And why, if you want to buy a home or a car, you are forced to take out loans that are more and more expensive. And yet, most people just take out the loan, make the big purchase and buy, and deal with the consequences. The real question is, how long will the American consumer be able to sustain an ever-rising cost of living before they can no longer take it? And what does not taking it anymore really look like? Historians will look back and say this inflationary period, 2020 to 2023, was on par with the Great Inflation of the 1970s. This period may even take the title. Whether you lived through the last Great Inflation or are yet too young to understand what the country went through back then, this book is for you. In fact, the book you are listening to was not written for economists, nor was it written for historians. This project began 20 years ago as a way to describe what is happening to the American dollar to everyday Americans. In layman's terms, the way you feel inflation is that everything seems more expensive. For example, every year the Farm Bureau calculates how much a traditional Thanksgiving home-cooked turkey dinner, turkey, mashed potatoes, corn casserole, the whole cornucopia, costs in comparison to the previous year. In the fall of 2022, the Farm Bureau estimated that the year's Thanksgiving dinner cost a total of $64.05, up $10.74, or 20% over 2021. The cost of dinner in 2021 had also increased by $6.41, or 14% over 2020. We only use Thanksgiving dinner as a metric because it is a thing everyone can grasp in some way. It's a metric economists use to see what matters to your budget and your family. Let me pose a question. At what point does inflation become a problem for you? What would it take for you to, say, stop buying turkeys at all? And how do you solve it? In old spaghetti western films, so named so because the films were made in Italy because it was cheaper to make them in Italy than in Hollywood, tales are told of men and women struggling in the American West to stay alive and maintain their freedoms. They had no money. They could only solve their problems using violence. Today, wealth and prosperity has raised the standard of living far beyond those images of Clint Eastwood squinting at the old Mexican bandito across from him, quick to draw, quick to kill, little remorse. Ashamed of what they have to do for a fistful of dollars. The tale of the American dollar is as old as the country itself. The modern details are not more complicated, except now we use computers instead of paper and words instead of guns, most of the time. Today, the bandits wear silk ties and look out over the Hudson River from their 40th floor suites. There was a time when money was based on something real. People were willing to kill over it. Now the dollar is worth less, or worthless. The demise of the dollar, in its simplest terms, is when the dollar means less and less over time. You might shake your fistful of dollars in anger at the powers that be, that is, if you even have enough bucks to muster. Our goal in this book is to help you understand what's happening behind the scenes, so you don't have to shake your fist at all. You just have to make good decisions based on your understanding of how the dollar works today. In fact, with all the division and derision spun in the media, on the television and on social media, the root cause of inflation is lost in the blender of political rhetoric. In turn, your ability to earn a living and how you take care of your family is as difficult as it has been in a half century. A computer programmer might ask, is the American dollar more a feature or a bug? Unfortunately for the money in your wallet, the U.S. dollar comes fully packaged with both. It is a feature that the U.S. dollar is the reserve currency of the world. That means that everybody in the global economic system uses dollars for international trade and exchange. The U.S. dollar has been the global reserve currency since the end of the Second World War. When an oil man in Oslo, Norway, wants to ship his crude across the Atlantic to Rio de Janeiro, Brazil, the product is priced in dollars. That's the feature. The dollar is useful for international trade. The dollar also comes equipped with a bug. When the international system gets out of whack, inflation sets in, and the prices rise for gas, chicken, cereal, clothes, shoes, toys, you name it. The American consumer is directly affected by international markets, even if they don't know it. And that can be scary. Once you understand where inflation comes from, you can put yourself in the right position at the right time. Is there any good news? You bet. There are steps that smart investors can take now to escape from their vulnerability to the dollar's erratic price moves and its inevitable fall. This book lays out the problem of inflation and explains how we got here. It also explains how, with a properly positioned portfolio, the demise of the dollar could actually be beneficial to your finances. Where should I put my money, Wigan? Readers and listeners ask on my podcast regularly. Keep listening. We will provide you with the specifics about what's really going on with the dollar and our economy, why the American consumer is addicted to spending beyond their means, and how foreign countries ultimately control our economic fate. Finally, we offer strategies you can put into action today to not only protect your financial freedom, but to thrive in an economic downturn and even in a crisis. The demise of the dollar is and has been an ongoing investigation since its inception in 2004. Demise follows the rise and fall, the pride and prejudice of the American dollar. We've also written books about the booms and busts in economic cycles in Financial Reckoning Day, and the political follies that have led to such exorbitant and foolhardy decisions and policies, that have led to annual deficits, mounting national debt, and political debauchery at the federal level in Empire of Debt. When we began this project in 2004, big economic words like bailouts, negative interest rates, and cryptocurrencies hadn't yet entered the financial conversation. Now it seems like it is all we talk about. We are fortunate to have been engaged in this project long enough that we can incorporate these new terms into our narrative and help you understand what's going on with your own fistful of dollars. Many of the ideas in this, the third edition of the book, have been updated based on discussions I've had in The Wigan Sessions, a podcast I conceived during a tornado warning late one Friday afternoon in downtown Baltimore. The tornado warning was rare enough, but we were already in lockdown during the COVID-19 pandemic. A colleague and I cracked open a bottle of wine and started taking notes on a whiteboard. The Wigan Sessions were born. I have been conducting interviews with hundreds of people since. Most are the people I have met during my three-decade career in the financial publishing industry. We've been posting them to YouTube and on social media. What I have discovered while doing these podcasts is there is a far greater need for understanding of the basic economic principles that govern our daily lives than what I originally thought. I've learned there's a danger of assuming I know what you, as a listener, are already aware of, and what I think is helpful for you to know. There's a divide. Social media and the fact that people don't really read books anymore, at least not in their entirety, makes the mission to communicate even more sacrosanct. While writing and editing the third edition of Demise of the Dollar, I discovered there were some concepts I got wrong in the first and second editions. Perfectionist that I am, in this third edition, I am attempting to not only correct those first misconceptions, but also help listeners to understand how the economy and the value of the dollar, the currency itself, has been changing so rapidly in our lifetimes. Without getting too ontological, I do want to comment on the very fact of being right or wrong in this field called economics. A lot of the time, people on both sides of the aisle like to throw the hot potato back and forth, pointing fingers, playing the blame game, or whatever you want to call it. That's just not how it works, frankly, in the markets or in life. And money and the economy, whether we like it or not, is a metaphor for our lives. So in hearing my words, please take my storytelling with the necessary grain of salt. If anything, it's an epic story. Enjoy. Addison Scott Wiggin, Baltimore, Maryland, 2022. Chapter 1. The Greenback Boogie. See the money. Want to stay for your meal. Get another piece of pie for your wife. I'm a robot. Suits theme. Our way in is through inflation. Most people think inflation is when things get more expensive. But what if we thought something different? What if we changed our definition of inflation and thought of rising prices as the result, not the definition? It is simple economics, actually. The more that you have of something, the less value it has. Think, if I had the one and only baseball card of Carl Yastrzemski, it would be worth a lot on the sports memorabilia market. If everyone had a Carl Yastrzemski card, mine wouldn't matter at all. The analogy fits for me because I grew up in New England. Carl Yastrzemski was a famous first baseman for the Boston Red Sox when I was a kid. Baseball cards were a thing, too. A Yastrzemski card, when you opened the bubblegum pack and got one. Euphoria. It was like, whoa, what, seriously? A Yastrzemski card? One card means a lot. But if there were thousands of them, billions or trillions of them, you get the point. The same thing goes for the American dollar bill. Substitute the Yastrzemski card with the American greenback, and the more dollars you have in the system, the less each dollar is worth. And today, those dollars are created by digits. What this means to the consumer, you and me, is that the dollar doesn't go as far. The items we want to buy feel more expensive. This is because you need more dollars to buy the things you want. But are things really more expensive? Or is the dollar just worth less because there are more of them in the system? It can be confusing. And around we go. That's why we call it the greenback boogie. We're going to explain what that means. The essential value of the American dollar itself is, and has been, in question. It's a feature of the economic system in which we live. The dollar is what's in your wallet, so it could present you with a big problem. What if we all start worrying about food on the table, our mortgages, taxes, retirement, tuition, gas for our commutes to work, and the cost of weddings and marriages and vacations, all at the same time? In the end, without what we call sound money, money whose value we can rely on, it is really hard to figure out if you have the right amount of money and whether the financial decisions you are making actually work. It doesn't really matter what currency you spend your money in. It's whether you can trust what you earn your money in and whether that money is going to be worth anything when you want to buy something. In earlier editions of the book, we were forecasting inflation. During the pandemic and now, as the economy begins opening up, inflation, rising prices, is in our face. In 2022, we began to really think about the phenomenon that we call inflation and what we can do to manage our money through it. That which is seen. Economists often look to the French philosopher Frédéric Bastiat's parable of the broken window for guidance on how to conduct an economic study. He says, with all things, there is always that which is seen and that which is not seen. The idea is very helpful when trying to understand the economy and the stock market at large, and, further, the problem of inflation and the effect it has on the money in your wallet. Bastiat writes, in the Department of Economy, an act, a habit, an institution, a law, gives birth not only to an effect, but to a series of effects. Of those effects, the first only is immediate. It manifests itself simultaneously with its cause. It is seen. The others unfold in succession. They are not seen. It is well for us if they are foreseen. Between a good and a bad economist, this constitutes the whole difference. The one takes account of the visible effect. The other takes account both of the effects which are seen and also of those which it is necessary to foresee. What is seen is the chairman of the Federal Reserve, currently Jerome Powell, announcing on television to the American people that he and his Federal Open Markets Committee, FOMC, the policy-deciding wing of the Fed, are raising interest rates yet again to tackle a so-called transitory inflation. Pulses quicken. Mortgage rates go up. Credit cards are harder to pay off. In 2021-2022, we saw a sea change in interest rate hikes. In a very short amount of time, the rate you needed to pay for a mortgage, home equity loan, or tuition payments increased by the quickest pace ever induced by the Federal Reserve. Most people don't know that interest rates determine the rate you have to pay on your credit cards and mortgages. You want to buy a house? You will have to take out a mortgage loan, unless you can pay up front. The interest rate at which you borrow for your mortgage loan is usually around a point above the rate decided by the FOMC. Whether you like it or not, Jerome Powell and his posse are making decisions that directly affect you as an investor and consumer. As the head of the Central Bank of the United States, colloquially dubbed the Fed, Powell announces the collective decision of America's several central bank governors. Altogether, the committee sets the interest rate for the American banking system, which, as we all know, is priced in American dollars. They call it the overnight Fed funds rate, and the financial media, yours truly included, have taken to Fed watching, as we call it, in the last 2 years. We hang on to every word issued by Powell and the FOMC because it determines the very value of our dollars, your money. What have they decided? Journalists want to know. What does it mean? We ask. Can we still buy homes without going bankrupt? Everyone and their mother worries. Then the keyboards get to clacking. To reiterate, we see the headlines and the analysis of the Fed's every interest rate manipulation. What we don't see, Jerome Powell's actions are actually the culmination of more than 3 decades of Federal Reserve trials in economic theory. You might still be thinking, why the hell should I care about what the Federal Reserve does to interest rates? I've got better things to do. To which I will respond, in trying to manage the American banking system, the Federal Reserve and the FOMC are directly influencing the value of the money in your wallet. When they tug at strings from up top, you feel it in your wallet. The Federal Reserve governors think they can manipulate the value of the dollar by lowering and raising rates based on signals from the 12 banks in the American Reserve Bank system. This is what we call the greenback boogie. It's a jazz beat, and it's confusing as it sounds. All the world's a stage to the Fed's two-step. But why? It hasn't always been this way. We haven't always been doing the greenback boogie. In fact, the Federal Reserve didn't always determine the value of the dollar, nor did it always manipulate the dollar in an attempt to regulate its ups and downs. For 23 years, between 1944 and 1971, the dollar was pegged to gold. That simply means that the gold price on the world market determined what the dollar could be redeemed for by other countries holding assets priced in dollars. The nation's central bank, the Federal Reserve, did not try to control the value of the dollar through interest rate adjustment as they do today. In 1971, what's called the gold standard for the U.S. dollar was disbanded. Then the story changed, and the boogie began. In the story of how we got here, there's a cast of characters. The protagonists are involved in complex discussions about how to organize the global economy and its currency system at the end of World War II, a war that destroyed most of Europe, Western Russia, and the Southeast Pacific. Let's begin. Welcome to Bretton Woods. Our story begins in a little town in New Hampshire on July 1, 1944. For the first time in modern history, an international agreement was reached to govern monetary policy among the world's nations. It was a chance to create a stable international currency once and for all. In total, 730 delegates from 44 nations met for 3 weeks at a resort in Bretton Woods. The conference was held at the Mount Washington Hotel in the shadows of the largest mountain in the Granite State, Mount Washington. Mount Washington is known for some of
Sample complete. Ready to continue?